From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, Iran. Our guest, Jay Solomon. He's chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and author of a new book, The Iran Wars, Spy Games, Bank Battles, and the Secret Deals That Reshaped the Middle East. For nearly 20 years, Jay Solomon has written from Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. He was the first American journalist to uncover the secret meetings between the United States and Iran that took place in Oman, which culminated in the nuclear deal to limit Iran's nuclear program. He led the coverage of the nuclear negotiations for the Wall Street Journal from 2011 through 2015. His new book, The Iran Wars, is a product of extensive, in-depth reporting and interviews with key players in the U.S.-Iranian rivalry, harking back to the September 11, 2001 terror attacks on U.S. soil, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, and the events that led to the nuclear agreement with Iran. He reveals the inherent contradictions inside the George W. Bush administration regarding the invasion of Iraq, which instead of weakening neighboring Iran, as some advisors had predicted, actually empowered it. In 2009, when hundreds of thousands of Iranians poured into the streets to protest election fraud, a group who came to be known as the Green Movement, Jay Solomon explains why President Barack Obama remained largely silent until a bloody crackdown by the regime forced him to speak out. In the book, Jay eloquently chronicles the battle between Iran and the United States on the military, financial, and covert levels. He describes the cyber warfare, financial sanctions, and the secret diplomacy employed by the Obama administration, which radically shifted U.S. foreign policy away from that of the George W. Bush administration. Jay Solomon joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Appreciate you having me. I'm a bit relieved it's over, but now I'm interested to have a broad audience of people internationally really read the book.
Well, I would highly recommend that they do so. It's a terrific book. Let's have you talk about why you wrote the book. What was the initial impetus and how did that change?
I kind of stumbled into this book maybe in 2006 when I was sent to cover the war in Lebanon between Hezbollah and the Israelis. And when I landed there, you could see very much in front of you this conflict between the Lebanese militia and the Israelis. But kind of behind the veil, you could tell that the Iranians were really big players in this operation and that it really was a regional conflict. The Iranians were using Hezbollah in the war against the Israelis. You had the Syrians, a close Iranian ally. You already had, by 2006, the conflict in Iraq and the Iranians sending in arms to support militias that were fighting the United States. So I think that 2006 war was the first time I really understood how big a player Iran was across the region. And as the Obama administration kind of took over from the Bush administration 2 years later, you could really see that U.S. foreign policy throughout the world was being tailored in many ways to deal with the Iranian threat, with the concern about its nuclear program, from sanctions to policies with China, Russia, the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Iranian issue kind of flowed through all of this. And that's why I really got interested in Iran as the biggest foreign policy challenge the Obama administration faced when it took office. And the deal he struck last year is going to be his signature foreign policy achievement, whether it gets what he wants, history will only tell us.
No question about it. And many analysts, critics say that it dominated so much, perhaps to the detriment of other policies that needed to be implemented. But let's talk about the deal itself and who won, who lost. You recently wrote for your own publication, The Wall Street Journal, that the Ayatollah wins with regard to this nuclear deal. Now, certainly, the restraints on the nuclear program can only be seen as a good thing. But why do you think Iran perhaps came out on the better end of the deal? And why is it that the Ayatollah is now blasting the United States for being untrustworthy when many would say, well, perhaps it was the United States that was trusting too much of Iran?
The negotiations, the secret negotiations between the U.S. and Iran really started in mid-2012 and then accelerated a year later when President Hassan Rouhani was elected and wanted to put Iran in a more favorable light, engage with the West. But at that time, and I think it's a big part of this book, was just how much damage U.S. sanctions and global sanctions had done to the Iranian economy. I don't think even people in the U.S. Treasury could have imagined when the sanctions really started to get ratcheted up in 2006, and then the big ones that came in 2012, which is essentially an oil embargo, could do what it did, which was basically cut Iran off from the global financial system, cut by more than half their oil exports, and cause their currency to drop by two-thirds. So I think the Iranians really were facing a potential existential threat in 2012 through the next year that they literally could not do business. The president before Rouhani, Ahmadinejad, basically looted the place, according to Iranian officials. So I think when you look where the Iranians started, and on top of that, you had oil prices starting to collapse, they were in a very vulnerable position. And the U.S. had these red lines initially from the Bush administration into the Obama administration, which were you can't produce nuclear fuel. If you do that domestically, it runs too much of a risk. You've got to dismantle a lot of these assets. You can't develop missile systems. They had a bunch of red lines. And what I think I document through the book pretty closely is that starting from such a weak position as the Iranians were in 2012, if you're Khomeini, the supreme leader, you think you got a lot of what you wanted. You got the sanctions pulled back, although their economy is still hurting, but you got the sanctions reduced. You're allowed to keep the infrastructure for your nuclear program. You have to constrain it, but in 10, 15 years, these constraints are lifted. And there's really nothing in this deal that prevents them to continue to develop ballistic missiles, other military systems to continue to try to project their power into Syria, Iraq. So if you're Khomeini, you feel pretty good about things. You got the economic pressure limited. You keep your program and you maintain that option down the road because you'll have this infrastructure to develop atomic bombs if they really wanted to, even if he passes from the scene. But he's trying to sort of perpetuate his system. And I think this deal could probably help him do that.
Then that leads to the question as to why the United States didn't use more leverage, all those sanctions that were constraining the Iranian regime. And as you said, having ceded on so many points, we hear both Secretary of State John Kerry and President Obama say, well, we needed to do this deal. Israel was perhaps about to strike militarily. We needed to avoid war at all costs. The Obama administration came in to power in part to do the opposite of George W. Bush. But was that an honest assessment? It was either this deal or war. Could something, a third option, have been negotiated, a harder bargaining position on the part of the United States?
I do think when President Obama came in office, he really did come into office on the mandate of I'm going to end Middle East wars. And his philosophy throughout the campaign is I can negotiate with U.S. adversaries, whether it's the Iranians, the Cubans, the Burmese. So as he moved forward, I think the administration, and I don't think it's correct, but the administration believed that if there was no deal, there was going to be a conflict, whether it was going to be because the Israelis went in there and took out some of the nuclear installations, or there was an escalation if talks failed between the U.S. and Iran. And I interviewed John Kerry in the book where he's like, I have no doubt whatsoever that, you know, we avoided the war. I personally, in the book, am pretty skeptical. I think if you look at the history of U.S.-Iran relations since the revolution, there's been a lot of hot spots, and there have been kind of brief military skirmishes in the Gulf. But I think the U.S. in a lot of ways have been extremely restrained, whether it was after the taking of 52 American diplomats in 1979, whether it was bombing of the U.S. Marine Corps barracks in Lebanon. There was talk about military retaliation, and there never really was. So I'm pretty skeptical that either the Bush administration or Obama administration were going to get sucked into a war. Were the Israelis going to do something? I think the book does detail a heightened tension in 2011 and 12, where Iranians were accusing the Israelis of assassinating their scientists. There were a bunch of plots globally against Israeli diplomats and citizens. But I think the administration really believed there was a conflict, and this averted it. And I think the Iranians knew that. I think that the language of the Obama administration, which was all options were on the table, but if we were to attack, they would definitely get a bomb. The Iranians were hearing that. So I think they pretty much knew the U.S. military option was off the table. The administration was kind of talking about sanctions not being sustainable, something I don't believe. I mean, maybe they wouldn't be sustainable for 15, 20 years, but because oil prices were falling, there was no sort of real evidence that the sanctions the U.S. had were going to collapse. So I was surprised that the concessions the U.S. made because they seemed to have had so much leverage. And I remember some of the Europeans who were taking part in the negotiations were kind of channeling to John Kerry, you know, if you don't like where they're going, why don't we just back off for a little while? We're not saying the talks can't resume. We're not saying there's a war, but we're in the driver's seat. They're the ones whose economy is in such bad shape. Be prepared to walk. And I don't think any journalists who were covering these talks really believed that the U.S. side was ever seriously considering walking out.
Jay Solomon, then there's the question of Syria. In 2013, President Obama issued the so-called red line warning that if, in fact, Bashar al-Assad, a very important client of the Iranians, back to the hilt by Iran, because Iran, of course, needs Syria as a conduit for Hezbollah in Lebanon, among other things, President Obama issued the red line, then he backed off. To what extent do you think the secret negotiations at that time, they were secret, between Iran and the United States, had something to do with his backing off? And had he implemented surgical strikes to punish the Assad regime for using chemical weapons on his own people, do you think, as some say the Obama administration thought, the Iranians would have walked away from the negotiations because the United States was hitting a very important ally?
The question of Syria is one of the more contentious issues I explored in the book. The administration is adamant that they had a policy towards Syria and they had a policy towards Iran and that they weren't interconnected. One U.S. official I talked to said, you know, Obama never really wanted to go into Syria. So to say it was all about the Iranian situation is inaccurate, which is not a very good comment anyways, because if you set a red line, usually it means you're willing to implement it. But Iranian officials I talked to in reporting the book said, diplomats leading the Iranian side were convinced that if the U.S. started to hit Assad, the Iranians' closest ally in the region, the IRGC, the Supreme Leader Khamenei, would have pulled the plug. They were already skeptical if they started to hit. Iran uses Syria for its strategic depth, its ability to move arms to Assad, to Hezbollah, to Islamic Jihad in the Palestinian territories is all dependent on maintaining Assad as a client. So if he's gone, that's a huge strategic threat. And the idea that they would have been able to continue to negotiate after this happened, the Iranians side said that's impossible. And what's interesting, if you follow the U.S. policy towards Syria from that red line moment in August of 2013 to where we are today, the U.S. position has almost come into alignment with the Iranians in a lot of ways. We report in the book that President Obama sent another letter to the Supreme Leader Khamenei in 2014, where he's basically saying, you know, if we can get this agreement on the nuclear issue, we can cooperate in fighting ISIS. And by the way, you should know that our operations in Syria are not targeting Bashar al-Assad or his forces. The U.S. was backing rebels in Syria, but basically instructing them and having them sign documents that said they weren't going to fight against the Assad forces. They were only targeting the Islamic State. And even this agreement that John Kerry made with Russia last week, it's basically aligned with the Iranians. Maybe it's trying to restrain the Assad forces in some ways, but whatever joint operation that might come about between the U.S. and the Russians, which in some ways would be with the Iranians too, because their militaries are almost fused with the Russians, they'll be targeting the Islamic State. So it could, in the end, end up bolstering the Assad government. So it's amazing when you see how far U.S. policy towards Syria kind of shifted, a 360 over the 3 years since those negotiations took place. It's a complete reversal.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Jay Solomon. He's chief foreign affairs correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, The Iran Wars, Spy Games, Bank Battles, and the Secret Deals That Reshaped the Middle East. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. Here's a shout-out to Warrant Officer Issa Kabiru Gwarzo from Benue State in Nigeria. Well, back to our special guest, Jay Solomon. Well, Jay, with regard to the U.S. policy vis-a-vis Syria, the Iran nuclear deal, we know there are major implications for U.S. Gulf Arab allies who are none too pleased with either one. They're not happy about the Iran deal, not because they don't want Iran not to get a nuclear weapon, but because they're very concerned about the sanctions relief and all those funds that could continue to bolster their malevolent activities in the region, funding terrorist organizations, whether it's Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and others, bolstering Bashar al-Assad, who has cracked down on his own people and has forced many of the opposition into the arms of more Islamist groups. So talk about the Gulf allies and the effect of this nuclear deal in particular on their relationship with the United States.
I think there was always skepticism towards this from day one amongst countries like Saudi Arabia, the UAE. I remember doing a trip with then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton just months after she took over the State Department, where she was talking to the UAE foreign minister who asked her about these negotiations, and she told him she didn't think it would work, which was interesting because she was basically undercutting Obama's most important foreign policy at the time. But if you saw how the talks were structured in a lot of ways in 2012, 2013, when they were in secret, they really went ahead and went behind the backs of the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Turks, and the Israelis. So that caused a lot of bad blood to begin with, the sense that, wow, you're doing something behind our back. You said there were these red lines that you weren't going to allow them to have certain capabilities, but now we can see you moving in that direction. There was also a question when the formal negotiations kind of came to light in late 2013. It was the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany. None of the countries that were directly kind of facing the Iranian threat were really part of the talks, which made many in the Saudi government upset, saying, like, how can you make decisions about our security when we're not involved? So there was that tension from the very beginning of the negotiations. And I think the final agreement, like you said, a Saudi or Emirati or an Israeli official will say, well, you know, no one's going to be upset that some of these programs are capped, but they don't think you can sort of hive off the nuclear issue from the other things the Iranians are doing. So lifting the sanctions, giving them access to billions of dollars. We just learned the U.S. sent $1.7 billion in hard cash to Tehran to get some of these Americans in prison. Their perception is, wow, we had Iran boxed in, and now we're pulling those restraints. And guess what? In 10 years, the restraints on the nuclear issue will be gone as well. So if you look down the road, the potential for a clash in their minds is heightened because you had the sanctions, you had them boxed in. And maybe the nuclear program was kind of there and advancing in some ways, but at least we had them curtailed. In 10 or 15 years, the sanctions will be gone, but the nuclear program and all these other issues that are a concern of them are still there. And that's why, you know, there's a lot of concern down the road that you're seeing so much tensions between the Saudis and the Iranians now. You see kind of a regional conflict pitting Sunni against Shia, and I think part of what happened are the Saudis in particular were like, we can't rely on the United States. We don't know what side they are on anymore. So we see Iranian support of Yemeni militias. We're going to go after them hard. And Syria has turned into this horrific conflict, basically a proxy war where the Iranians, through Hezbollah and their own forces, are backing Assad. And the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris have been moving money into some of the Sunni militias there. So the hope that this deal would somehow calm tensions, I think you could argue it's made it worse.
Calm tensions or even sort of open up a new chapter in U.S.-Iranian relations. We haven't seen that. And of course, we have to admit these are early days.
Right.
But nonetheless, speaking of better relations, let's go back quickly before our time runs out. You mentioned Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Now she's the Democratic nominee for the presidency. And in the book, you write that she actually regrets back in 2009 when the Green Movement erupted in protest to the elections when President Ahmadinejad won, presumably because of fraud. People came out in the streets, and it looked like a real turning point for Iran, a natural uprising that could have really threatened or jeopardized the supreme leader and the Islamic Republic. But you said that she said in the book that she regrets that the United States didn't speak out more forcefully in favor, and President Obama didn't because now we know that he wanted to, you know, really change the relationship. He didn't want to jeopardize the letter he wrote to the Ayatollah at that time. Only later he, of course, criticized the crackdown. Do you think this was a missed opportunity for the United States?
I mean, I think it was in a lot of ways. Like you said, Obama, just months after taking office, started to set up this path towards negotiations, and he knew the supreme leader was the ultimate arbiter on all these decisions. So he sends these letters. He gives this famous speech on Nowruz, the Persian New Year, basically saying, know that our policy is not regime change. He kind of had set up this channel, and then Khomeini actually responded at one point. And people who've read the letter said it's a bit of a harangue, but it kind of leaves the door open in some ways. And then you have the Green Revolution, which was millions of people on the street. And officials I talked to who were part of the debate said, look, we were getting very mixed signals. You had some dissidents or part of the uprising saying, don't say anything. It will give the Supreme Leader some excuse to brand us lackeys and crack down. Others were saying, he's going to do that anyways. So you might as well give us some vocal support. We're not calling for arms. We're not calling for money. But, you know, vocal support showing that the world is watching is really important. And it was interesting. The CIA actually has a kind of programs in place in most countries in the world that if there's an uprising, they could provide communications equipment or some other things to dissidents and oppositions. The White House very much told them to stand down. And Obama basically not only didn't do anything, he made comments in the crucial kind of first 10 days that maybe this opposition won't be any better than what they have now. I mean, he kind of talked it down. And then there was this brutal crackdown over the next 2 to 3 months. And now you talk to members, activists who were part of the Green Movement, they said that the crackdown was so brutal, there's not much of a stomach now for much democratic change. They've been sort of cowed in Iran. So when Hillary Clinton is saying, I think we missed an opportunity, I think that's what she means. There was a kind of organic protest movement, not that it necessarily would have succeeded and not necessarily the U.S. could have done much, but at least to have been vocally on side of the opposition would have been important. And I think what kind of fed even more this insecurity or confusion in the Middle East was 2 years later, there's an uprising in Egypt against Mubarak, who's an ally of the United States. And it was similar in some ways to the Green Movement revolution. And in this case, Obama comes out very forcefully and says, Mubarak has to stand down. So it's like, are you on the side of the Ayatollah? Why these different standards? Why does it seem that your actions are all basically helping or entrenching this regime in Iran that's hostile to the United States? It's been very confusing to American allies.
It's confusing. And I guess the only answer we can come up with is this Iran deal, this nuclear agreement, seems to supersede everything in the mind of President Obama. And everything was subordinated to that. And back to the Syria question, I've spoken to Syrian analysts who say that had the Obama administration done some surgical strikes on Bashar al-Assad's Air Force as a signal, you know, we mean what we say,
yep,
that probably the Iranians would not have walked away from the table because they needed the Iran deal much more than they needed to protect the person of Bashar al-Assad. Now, that's just,
sure,
just some
analysis.
Well,
they could have walked away and come back, too.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's the whole point. And that leads me to the question of, do Iranian leaders, whether it's the supreme leader who really runs the country, or the diplomats like Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, or Hassan Rouhani, the new president, are they playing the United States both under the George W. Bush administration and Obama? Now, we haven't talked about George W. Bush, but one has to wonder why you would invade Iraq, predominantly Shia country, thinking that somehow that would marginalize Shia-dominated Iran as opposed to empowering it. But we can get into that before we close the program. So are U.S. diplomats getting played, in a sense, by Iran and coming out on the shorter end of the stick?
I mean, the Iranian diplomats are very cagey and sophisticated. And what's always hard to tell when you're watching them is you've got the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guards who are in charge. And then you have these very savvy Western-oriented English-speaking diplomats who can engage very well with the U.S. And who's really in charge? Clearly, the Supreme Leader makes the decisions. What is very difficult to tell was it a good pop, bad cop scenario? Were Zarif and Rouhani just like, did they really want major changes, or were they just kind of giving that as a facade? I think Rouhani and Zarif probably do want a better relationship. They want to open the economy, and they understood that the economics of the situation were so bad that they actually kind of lobbied the Supreme Leader to back this process, and they successfully did it. But now it feels like with the pressure lifting, with the economic threat lifting, Khomeini is sort of turning on these guys. You've seen people around the President Rouhani, his brother, others being arrested. You've seen a lot of dual nationals who have gone back, whether from Britain or the U.S., get arrested. And I think these were some of the people who probably would have been a bridge for economic opening or better relations to the West. So now that the deal is done, it feels like that window has closed. And it feels like the Supreme Leader played an incredibly weak hand extremely well, given where they were 3 or 4 years ago.
And the United States maybe played a very strong hand, not very well.
Yeah. I mean, I think the book really does argue that the sanctions and the setting up of the negotiations was done brilliantly. No one thought you could basically take Iran off the oil markets without potentially hurting the United States. And that it was executed. The U.S. did an incredible job of implementing these sanctions without causing this spike in oil prices.
And this was under President Obama.
It was under both Bush and Obama, yeah. It started with Bush, and Obama, during his first term, really executed it well, which is why the question is, when you actually got to the negotiations, it's kind of against human nature to think if you start easing the pressure, the other side is going to make big concessions. It's only when you're staring over a cliff, usually a human is going to make a concession. And the tactics of the actual talks still are very confusing, why they didn't use that leverage more.
We gave a bit of short shrift to George W. Bush, but George W. Bush authorized the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Some of his advisors at the time thought somehow that this would marginalize Iran, when in fact it did the opposite. This in itself is extraordinary. We have to acknowledge that it was President George W. Bush who really emboldened Iran in the region, the very country that they wanted to weaken. So that started everything to some extent. But were there opportunities missed then also, Jay Solomon, to try to either cooperate tactically on Afghanistan maybe with Iran that the George W. Bush administration forfeited?
The chapter in the book I really enjoy is where the U.S. goes into Afghanistan, the CIA goes in after 9/11 and shows up in the Panjshir Valley to hook up with the Northern Alliance. The rebels there fighting the Taliban and realize the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranians, have been there for years. There's kind of a give and take where in the end, the Americans and the Iranian diplomats coordinated and cooperated in getting Hamid Karzai in as the first post-Taliban president in Afghanistan. So there was some cooperation there, but it always felt that on Iran's other side, when it's facing the Arab world rather than the Farsi-speaking or countries in Central Asia that are traditionally part of the Persian Empire, it's much more difficult to cooperate with them there. And if you look at the months leading into the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the toppling of Saddam Hussein, the Pentagon captured a lot of Saddam's intelligence files. And you could tell that the Iraqis under Saddam, as a U.S. buildup for war, were almost more concerned by what they saw the Iranians doing on their borders as far as activating Shiite militias, moving arms into proxies. They were essentially laying in wait for the U.S. to topple Saddam and to come in very aggressively into Iraq with everything from business people to intelligence officials. And it's inexplicable how the U.S. couldn't see what the Iranians were doing and how the toppling of Saddam was going to play into the Iranian hand in a lot of ways. And that's definitely what happened. Even now, you can see the military in Iraq is basically run now by Shiite militias, independent militias, that are getting funding, arms, and training from the Revolutionary Guard in Tehran.
And then finally, we note last week that Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif writes an opinion editorial in the New York Times, you know, basically excoriating the Wahhabi doctrine that emanates from Saudi Arabia, saying that this is the worst scourge in the region. And I don't think anybody can really quibble with the types of extremism and violence that do emanate from this very narrow interpretation of Islam. But I think it just underscores that we're seeing really a showdown now, even more than ever, notwithstanding the nuclear agreement, between Iran, a Shiite power, Persian power, vis-a-vis the Sunni Gulf Arab states. And I wonder if President Obama appreciates this very big challenge that he's leaving to the next administration, and whether or not this Iran deal, notwithstanding the good that it may be doing in capping the nuclear program in Iran, perhaps is offset by these very big challenges and potential for a greater conflict.
I did pick up sometimes from talking to Obama administration officials that in some ways they have this kind of idealized image of the Iranians that they're fighting al-Qaeda, they're fighting Islamic State, therefore they could emerge as this ally against them. But first, Khomeini has been clear he doesn't want to cooperate. And B, if you look at what's happened in the region and what's fueled the Sunni-Shia conflict, yeah, the Saudis have definitely played their role, so has their ideology. But if you look at Bashar al-Assad and the slaughter of a largely Sunni population by his government, which is a sect of Shiism, and the support they've gotten from Iran in doing, you know, barrel bombing, chemical weapons attacks. And if you look in Iraq going back since the overthrow of Saddam, you saw Nouri al-Maliki was also very close to the Iranians, kind of marginalizing and sort of persecuting the Sunni minority in Iraq, which I don't think there's any debate that that fed the creation of ISIS. So, like you said, I don't think Zarif's interpretation of the Saudi role is necessarily wrong. But I think to give the Iranians a free pass or to think they're somehow absolved of any role in this terrorism and Sunni Shia sectarian tensions. I think that's not understanding what's happened over the past decade.
The book is called The Iran Wars, Spy Games, Bank Battles, and the Secret Deals That Reshaped the Middle East. The author, Jay Solomon, he's chief foreign affairs correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Jay, once again, congratulations on a terrific book. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Jonah Cummings. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.